This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As recently as this summer, Sam Bankman-Fried was known as a cryptocurrency wunderkind. He co-founded FTX, one of the biggest cryptocurrency exchanges in the world, which helped him make more than $22 billion before his 30th birthday. But Bankman-Fried wasn't about to shower all that cash on crypto boy toys like helicopters, private islands, or a mega yacht. Or so we were told. Sam Bankman-Fried was instead going to travel the path of humility, of generosity, of altruism. He'd keep only a tiny slice of his earnings. The rest, he'd give away.
In the end, the way I think about it basically is something like, well, you know, I don't know, maybe like 1% of it or something, I'll, you know, end up using on myself. But if I do well, and obviously if I underperform, then these numbers don't have to change. But if I do well, I think that should be kind of plenty for me.
That was Bankman-Fried espousing doing well by doing good back in September on CNBC. Well, a mere 2 months later, early November, FTX, which had been valued at north of $30 billion earlier this year, collapsed. A giant star sucking itself down into a black hole before our very eyes, and in mere days. On November 7th, though, Bankman-Fried tweeted the crypto equivalent of that everything's fine, dog in hell, fire everywhere meme when he posted, quote, FTX is fine. Assets are fine. Now, we could spend the entire hour trying to understand exactly why FTX went boom the way it did. And honestly, that would be great fun, because just listen to how Bloomberg's Matt Levine describes FTX's bizarro land balance sheet. Levine writes, quote, FTX shot its customer money into some still unexplained reaches of the astral plane, noting that FTX backed investor cash with not one, but two tokens that it entirely made up. Quote, the balance sheet that FTX circulated consisted mostly of stuff it made up. Its balance sheet consisted mostly of stuff it made up. You can't do that. That's not how balance sheets work. That's not how anything works, Levine says. But alas, we're not going to spend the entire hour talking about that, frankly, because people are still trying to figure out that key question. Where did all of FTX's real money go? Instead, we're going to talk about something else. Something arguably more important, because it could have an impact not just on billionaire investors, but on everyday people. It's the philosophy that Sam Bankman-Fried says drove him, the one that inspired him to create FTX. It's called effective altruism, and it's a philosophy of applying data and evidence to pinpoint the most effective use of philanthropic dollars. It also champions something called earn to give. The idea that one should make as much money as they can so they can donate more dollars overall, as Bankman-Fried himself described to Forbes back in May.
You know, that's what I've been doing. So I've, I got into finance in the first place to try and maximize the amount that I can donate to some of the most effective causes.
Bankman-Fried says he donated more than $100 million to charities and nonprofits this year alone. Prior to November, he was being compared to Warren Buffett and Bill Gates for not only amassing all that money, but wanting to give most of it away. He self-mythologized to Forbes in May, saying,
it doesn't matter if I make the world better or if someone else does it. Better is better, and you know, if I can do anything to help other people help the world, that's just as good. So it's obviously, it's sort of part of me would love my legacy to be, you know, generically positive, but I just don't think that's what matters. In the end, it's the mark that we actually leave on the world, not the mark we're perceived to leave on the world, that matters.
That's not how it's turning out, though. Sam Bankman-Fried is currently in handcuffs. He was arrested in the Bahamas and is now facing charges in a New York courtroom. Why?
I think it's fair to say that by anyone's lights, this is one of the biggest financial frauds in American history.
That was Damian Williams, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, after announcing an 8-count indictment for fraud against Bankman-Fried back in December. Or I should say December 8th, just a little earlier this month. But According to Bankman-Fried, no, this is all a misunderstanding, he says. In fact, he told the New York Times on November 30th that, quote, he had just had a bad month.
Look, I screwed up. Like, I was CEO. I was the CEO of FTX. And, I mean, I'd say this again and again, that means I had a responsibility. That means that I was responsible, ultimately, for us doing the right things. And, I mean, we didn't. Like, we messed up big.
So here's the thing. Again, we return to that underlying philosophy of effective altruism. And really the question for us today is, what impact does the Bankman-Fried collapse have on this movement? Could it be discredited entirely? Or is Sam Bankman-Fried just a distraction, albeit a very large one, from what is fundamentally a movement that is channeling mostly hard-earned dollars to truly deserving philanthropies? All right, so let's start today with Molly White. She's a software engineer who maintains the blog Web3 is Going Great. It documents scams and crashes in the crypto world. And she just recently wrote a terrific post that has the subhead of Sam Bankman-Fried tells me he doesn't think he'll be arrested several hours before he is arrested. Molly White, welcome.
Hello.
Okay, so first of all, let's go in, if we can, I'd like to go back to that moment where you just talked to him before he was arrested. What was Sam Bankman-Fried's, like, kind of, you know, demeanor like?
Well, shortly before he was arrested, he had spent a lot of time talking to just about anyone who would listen. And he was repeating a lot of the same points, which was that the whole collapse was all just a mistake. He didn't have the insight that he should have had into his company, and that, you know, it was all just an issue of negligence, pretty much. And so, you know, he was doing interviews where he was, I think, trying to sort of launder his reputation a little bit to make it seem like this wasn't fraud, but rather just a big oversight.
He was doing a lot of interviews, in fact, right? It seems like he was everywhere, September, October, and November. Just as an aside, as you were talking to him, wait, was he actually playing video games while he was talking to you about, like...
He was.
That seems a little strange.
Yes, and it's also something he was sort of known for doing. I mean, he had been profiled in the past with investors saying that he would be playing League of Legends during investor calls where he was trying to solicit hundreds of millions of dollars. And apparently at the time, they saw that as sort of a fun, quirky indication that he's just such a genius that he can multitask. But I think most people would consider that to be somewhat reckless or, if nothing else, disrespectful.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, it's the whole crypto part of this that makes we non-crypto folks a little tough or impenetrable for what happened to FTX to understand. It's hard. So, I mean, how simply can you describe what we know so far about why FTX collapsed in a matter of days?
So the important thing to know here is that FTX was a cryptocurrency exchange, but it also had a sort of sister company, also founded by Sam Bankman-Fried, called Alameda Research, which was a trading firm. And I think it all boils down to the fact that Sam Bankman-Fried was funding the trading that was happening at Alameda Research with customer funds from the FTX exchange, which is sort of the cardinal sin among cryptocurrency exchanges. You know, if your customers are putting their assets on your platform, you're supposed to just hold on to them. And so that, you know, if they ever want to withdraw their assets, you can just give them right back. But FTX was taking those customer funds and using them for other purposes that they were not supposed to be.
Shooting the money into some unknown astral plane, as Matt Levine at Bloomberg put it.
Correct.
Okay. So we really don't know what happened with the actual investor money?
Well, they're starting to untangle that a little bit. And it sounds like a lot of it went to investments in various other companies that were done without much due diligence. They went to real estate purchases in the Bahamas, and they went to personal loans to FTX executives, including Sam Bankman-Fried.
None of this sounds like a philanthropy that could have taken that money and done good things with it.
No, it's definitely very different from what Sam Bankman-Fried was at least portraying to media that he planned to do with his vast wealth.
Okay. So tell me, I mean, what do you understand, Molly, about the original you know, inspiration that Bankman-Fried had to co-found FTX. I mean, we had that cut where he, like, getting into finance was really, he was inspired to use finance as a way to, you know, practice effective altruism. Do you believe that?
It's certainly what he has said. I mean, his story is that, you know, he went to MIT for undergrad. He met the effective altruist, Will McCaskill there, who encouraged him to get into effective altruism, encouraged him to pursue this earning to give philosophy. And so Sam Bankman-Fried says that, you know, when he was having that conversation, he had originally planned to go work for an animal welfare nonprofit after he graduated, but that this, you know, he calls it a very important conversation in his trajectory, that this conversation inspired him instead to start Alameda Research, the trading firm. You know, first he went into finance, he worked at Jane Street in, you know, the traditional financial world, and then he began Alameda Research, all because he says that he was trying to amass as much wealth as he could in order to do as much good as he could. Whether or not that is true or is just sort of a, you know, convenient justification for becoming a billionaire is, I think, up to the observer to decide.
Yeah. So in a few minutes, we're going to take a step back from Sam Bankman-Fried and trying to understand effective altruism more clearly. But do you think this is the equivalent of a bank run on crypto? Is this sort of a temporary death knell for crypto?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there's pretty unprecedented loss of faith in the crypto industry right now, I think, where people are very worried about giving their funds to platforms like FTX. And we've definitely seen a retraction in the cryptocurrency industry where, you know, Bitcoin prices are very low, other cryptocurrency prices are very low. But I think it's probably premature to call it the death of crypto.
Okay. Reports of its death are premature. Okay. So Molly, hang on here for just a second because we've got to take a quick break and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about effective altruism. And that is the philosophy that Sam Bankman-Fried says underlied his desire to found the now completely collapsed cryptocurrency exchange FTX. So we're trying to understand really what effective altruism is and the future of this movement. I'm joined today by Molly White. She's a software engineer who maintains the blog Web3 is Going Great. Now, I just want to play a couple little more clips here about why, that demonstrate why, regarding FTX, Bankman-Fried is facing those fraud charges in New York. So first of all, this is Sam Bankman-Fried himself. He stepped down as CEO of FTX after that November collapse and after the company went into bankruptcy. His lawyers advised him not to speak to the media, but he was all over the place doing just about any interview he could get instead, including a big one with the New York Times. So here's Bankman-Fried speaking from the Bahamas before he got arrested on November 30th. This is at the DealBook Summit.
Clearly, I made a lot of mistakes or things I would give anything to be able to do over again. I didn't ever try to commit fraud on anyone. I was excited about the prospects of FTX a month ago. I saw it as a thriving, growing business. I was shocked by what happened this month. And, you know, reconstructing it, were there things I wish I had done differently?
They're shocked. Shocked, he says. But why? Because so many of the things that FTX did as business practice seem to explain maybe why the whole thing collapsed. For example, here's attorney John J. Ray III in front of the House Committee on Financial Services on December 13th, so just a few days ago, Ray took over as CEO of FTX after the company filed for bankruptcy. And he's known, well known for restructuring troubled companies, including the implosion of the energy trading firm Enron. Okay, so John J. Ray told the House committee that he had never seen, quote, such an utter failure of corporate controls at FTX at every level of an organization.
This one is unusual, and it's unusual in the sense that literally, you know, there's no record keeping whatsoever. It's in the absence of record keeping. Employees would communicate, you know, invoicing and expenses on Slack, which is, you know, essentially a way of communicating for chat rooms. They use QuickBooks, a multi-billion dollar company using QuickBooks.
QuickBooks?
QuickBooks. Nothing against QuickBooks, very nice tool, just not for a multi-billion dollar company. There's no independent board, right? We had one person really controlling this. No independent board. That's highly unusual in a size company this is.
I also had that same response, right? QuickBooks? QuickBooks is for you. It's for me. It's not for a company whose assets were supposedly more than $30 billion. We're going to talk about effective altruism, I promise, but I keep getting sucked back into the FTX black hole. Molly White, can you explain at all this whole QuickBooks part of the story?
I honestly was kind of impressed that they had even started using QuickBooks. I assumed it was all just sort of back of the napkin math back there. So, but yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it just goes to show that they had no idea where their money was. They had no interest in trying to determine where their money was. And, you know, it was all just sort of luck, I think, that was keeping things afloat for as long as it did.
Oh. So strange. Okay, so let's put Sam Bankman-Fried and what he did at FTX aside for just a moment. And now, as I keep promising, really want to talk about the impact that he may have on this movement of effective altruism. So joining us now is Richard Chappell. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Miami, and his research focuses on moral theory and applied ethics, including effective altruism. Professor Chappell, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, I just, to be frank, I think a lot of us had never even heard of effective altruism, which is actually quite a widespread movement. But many of us hadn't heard until Sam Bankman-Fried. So, help us understand, how would you define plainly what effective altruism, in its purest sense, is?
Sure. So, for me, I think the central idea of effective altruism is about trying to help others as effectively as you can with whatever portion of time, money, resources you're willing to put towards that altruistic project. So the key notion here is on the effectiveness. And there's something that's quite distinctive about effective altruism, where normally we think of charity, philanthropy as something that's very subjective, that's based on maybe personal connections or interests or emotional pull, maybe your local community, something just grabs your attention, so maybe you donate a bit to it. Effective altruism is much more focused on thinking strategically about where to give and how to do good. And so not just going with whatever first grabs your attention, but trying to look at all the options and work out, what's the very best thing I could do with these resources?
Okay, so
it turns out some are 100 times more effective than others. So okay. It really makes a big difference.
So I want to get back to how you measure that in just a moment. But to be clear, so it's not like, so giving as much as you can, but not to necessarily like passion projects, right? But to things that are measurably more effective in terms of making some kind of difference. How is that measurement made?
Right. So there's a lot of different ways. I mean, the basic idea is to try to have some kind of evidential base for making a good decision about where to give. And one traditional approach is to look at metrics like quality adjusted life years. And so you can look at different global health charities and have a look at what kind of evidence do they have for how many lives they're saving per dollar donated, or how much they're improving people's lives, improving the quality of their lives. And you can sort of compare these and try to work out which one seems to be looking the best. And so an organization, GiveWell, givewell.org, is sort of seen as the gold standard for making those kind of evaluations. And so a lot of effective altruists will then sort of defer to those kind of charity evaluators and the empirical evidence they have for which organizations are really effective.
Okay. So it relies than on measurable data. But of course, based on what you choose to measure, there will be certain types of philanthropies, or I should say charities, that fall into those categories and others that do not. So what are the main focus areas right now for effective altruism?
So I think there's four broad areas that differ a lot in how sort of robustly evidenced they are versus more speculative. So the most robustly evidenced is global health charities. So those are the ones which GiveWell is evaluating. And for effective altruists who are wanting the strongest, most robust evidence that they can be really confident that their donation is going to save lives and do good, then donating to those sort of broad global health areas. Particular charities include things like the Against Malaria Foundation, which provides anti-malarial bed nets and saves lives very, very cheaply. And others include things like GiveDirectly, where just money is given directly to people in some of the poorest villages in the world, and they can use that money in whatever way they deem they most need. So again, this is shown to do a lot of good when they follow up and see how it's spent.
Yeah.
A second cause area that's quite different is non-human animal welfare. And here, effective altruists tend to focus less on the standard sort of stray dogs and cats in our local neighborhood kind of thing, and the much more neglected but high-scale cause of factory farming. So there are billions of animals effectively tortured and killed every year in factory farms. And effective altruists are interested in ways that we can improve the living conditions of animals on factory farms, or even hopefully eventually reduce or prevent the existence of those really bad kinds of farming conditions in the first place. So that's the second cause area. And a reason for that is just it turns out there's some evidence that it's much more cost effective to reduce animal suffering in this way compared to how difficult it is to improve human lives and prevent human suffering. So there's an argument that it's much more cost effective if you weight animal interests anywhere as close to human interests. But that's obviously controversial and people disagree about it. The third broad cause area is caring about future generations. So that involves things like looking at what kinds of risks could cause human civilization to, you know, come to an end. So things like nuclear war, things like engineered pandemics made to be much more lethal than COVID and so forth, but have similarly like global spread. And so looking at ways to protect against and prevent those kinds of existential risks. So looking to the future and trying to ensure that humanity has a future and a positive future is another broad cause area. And then finally, somewhat controversially, but I think it's an interesting one, is the sort of meta idea of growing effective altruism itself and trying to get more people involved in looking at these cause areas, donating to these cause areas, and so sort of building the support for all those other projects that matter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the philanthropic world, that's the metaphorical equivalent to administrative overhead for the effective altruism movement. We'll come back to that in a second. But you had mentioned that for some of these causes, effective altruists say they have funneled their money in directions where the outcome was 100 times more effective. Did I hear that correctly?
That's right. So it's a general estimate, just that when you compare how far money goes in a rich country like America to comparing to some of the world's poorest countries, just in general, it's 100 times more effective to spend money in the poorer countries. So that's just a sort of rough estimate for how much good you're going to be able to do with your money donating to a local charity in America versus the most effective global charities. We should expect them to be roughly 100 times more effective on average. And the very best ones might be even more so.
Okay. So, but the one thing that I do wonder about is I completely understand the idea of wanting basically your money to work as effectively as possible, and then having a data-driven means by which to do that. But what about all of those charitable causes that perhaps are harder to measure with data or numbers? The arts come to mind, or, you know, sports for kids. I don't know. Pick any one of them. How do those philanthropies or those charities fall into the effective altruism world?
So they're basically deprioritized. So it's a controversial thing about effective altruism that it says it's kind of a mistake to donate to opera houses or to donate to the local arts museum when you could instead donate that money and save someone's life. So it's really explicit about making those hard trade-offs and saying, given the opportunity costs, is it really worth donating to this local organization, given how much more good I reasonably can expect I could do donating elsewhere? Now, there is room for more speculative funding. So some of the causes I mentioned, especially trying to protect future generations, it's very uncertain how best to do that. If you try to donate to a pandemic prevention lobbying group, for example, it's very uncertain whether you're going to be able to convince the politicians to pass good legislation based on that. So it is speculative. And so effective altruists are open to speculative ideas, but it needs to have enough sort of scale of importance behind it that it seems like a good bet. Given the uncertainty, a chance of making a difference in preventing the next pandemic is huge. Whereas the chance of improving, you know, Americans' access to sports or paintings just doesn't seem like it has the same kind of importance as saving people's lives or preventing the next pandemic. So that is a key thing about effective altruism, is that it asks us, is this cause plausibly, like on any plausible measure, the most important thing in the world that you could be doing? Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then it invites you to think, well, what else could you be doing that would be more important? And that's an important question to ask.
Yeah. Molly, I appreciate you listening along here patiently as Professor Chappell sort of walks us through the world of effective altruism. I'm just wondering what you think about the fact that there is, it wants to be, or says it's a, you know, essentially a data-driven movement that, to use a Silicon Valley phrase, you know, would optimize how money is used for charitable causes. That would seem to me to have a particular draw for people who, you know, live in the world of finance or tech, and their whole being is centered around trying to optimize things.
Yeah, I think that was probably part of what appealed to Sam Bankman-Fried. I mean, he, growing up, was really interested in utilitarianism. And I think that, you know, you can sort of see that throughout his later life, where he was, you know, interested in producing the most good, almost by any means necessary, you know. So it seems as though he believed that in order to maximize his contributions to various charitable causes, it was okay to defraud his customers. And, you know, I think that that's sort of the risk of things like effective altruism and, you know, similar philosophies, is that they can be taken to these extremes where, you know, earning to give, for example, could mean that you should earn as much money through any means possible, including fraud or crime or, you know, industries that harm people, in order to then give it to causes that you believe are the most effective. And in some cases, those are causes that, you know, most people would not necessarily consider to be the most important, like things around, you know, the use of AI, threats of AI 1,000 years from now, you know, various long-term issues that are kind of difficult to predict right now. And so I think, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried very much believed in that type of philosophy, or at least he claims that he did.
Mm. So, Professor Chappell, Molly pinpointed an important word that I'd love to get your response to, that this is sort of a utilitarian-flavored movement. What would you say to that?
Yes and no. So the aspect of utilitarianism that effective altruism picks up on is that when you're trying to do good, it's worth doing more good rather than less. So the optimization element is part of utilitarian moral theory, and it's also part of effective altruism. But there's a second part of utilitarianism that's much more controversial, that isn't essentially part of effective altruism, and that's the lack of constraints. That's the idea of doing whatever it takes to achieve better outcomes. And that's not a part of effective altruism per se. There are many non-consequentialists as well as utilitarians amongst effective altruists who think that insofar as you're doing good, you should try to do more good rather than less. But there are important moral constraints on that. You shouldn't do it by violating people's rights. And even those who are utilitarians in theory, like myself, think that there are very important constraints in practice, and that when you violate people's rights, for example, generally, we should expect from looking at history that that's not going to achieve a greater good. It's going to do more harm. And I think the example of Sam Bankman-Fried just further verifies that.
Mm. Now, quickly, we just have a minute before our next break. Have you ever met Sam Bankman-Fried, Professor Chappell?
I've not, no.
You've not met. Okay. But there's a name that we should talk about that's quite important to the effective altruism movement, and that's Will McCaskill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. So just give, in the minute we have before the break, can you just quickly tell us who he is? And then we'll talk more about him in a minute.
Sure. So Will McCaskill is a moral philosopher at Oxford. who became very central in sort of helping to found the effective altruism movement through a couple of Oxford organizations, Giving What We Can, that he co-founded with Toby Ord, another philosopher at Oxford, and 80,000 Hours, which is the career-focused aspect of Organization for Effective Altruism, which came up with the idea of earning to give. So Will McCaskill was quite central in those, and they came together in what's now known as the Center for Effective Altruism. And that sort of really grew the effective altruism community from there. So he's seen as something of a thought leader amongst effective altruists, a philosopher who's helped to develop a lot of the underlying ideas and try to put them into practice through these organizations and kind of community, the community that's built up around them.
Okay. And as Molly had said earlier, he's the one who Sam Bankman-Fried had met decided that effective altruism might be a philosophy he would follow in co-founding FTX. Okay, so we have a lot more to talk about what the collapse of FTX might have, or the impact it might have on effective altruism, and we'll do that in just a second. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Friday, we're going to be talking about the healing power of music, because studies do show that music can, in fact, change our blood pressure, our heart rate, even help people manage pain. So we want to hear your stories. How has music helped you through a tough time? Have you felt that almost that physical transformation when it comes to listening to music? Do you have a specific piece that does that to you? We'd love to hear your story. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. You can also find us on our new On Point Vox Pop app. If you haven't already downloaded it, just look for On Point Vox Pop. Okay, so that's for Friday. Today we're talking about the effective altruism movement, what it is, and what impact it's the collapse of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried in particular, FTX's co-founder, might have on the effective altruism movement. I'm joined by Richard Chappell. He's associate professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. He identifies as a member of the effective altruism movement. And Molly White is with us as well. She's a software engineer who maintains the blog Web3 is going great. Now, one of the things that Professor Chappell, if I understand correctly, it's not that effective altruism espouses is not just giving away as much money as you can, but that should require changes in how you live your own life, a certain sort of frugality.
Well, I think that's actually controversial. So effective altruism is a pretty big tent, and it includes some people who are really extremely altruistic, some people who have, you know, donated a kidney to a stranger to do more good, and others who donate everything they earn above like the median income or whatever they need to as a living wage. So they're very extremely altruistic people, but there are also people who just, like myself, I just donate 10% of my income and otherwise just live comfortably with my family on the rest, a pretty normal kind of life. So there's a big range, I think, in terms of what people do. The main expectation is just that you include as part of your life a project that involves, you know, really wanting to help others. And insofar as you're working towards that project, you're doing that portion of it as effectively as you can.
So then I guess the difference, if frugality in one's own life isn't a requirement of this philosophy, does that not clash with utilitarianism a little bit? Because then how are you using the money that you're earning as effectively as possible if a lot of it's just going to your own surplus comfort?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's one respect in which effective altruism is much broader than utilitarianism, because it doesn't have that strict requirement of doing as much as you possibly can with all of your effort and resources. It's just saying, do some substantial amount to help others and do that effectively. But there's room to give extra weight to your own interests, to your family, to friends. It doesn't have the strict impartiality and kind of universal scope that utilitarianism as a moral theory has. So it's a bit more commonsensical and a bit broader in that respect.
So this to me actually sounds, in a sense, like kind of a data-driven secular tithing, right? Because like, so what's the difference then, right? Except for the effective part.
Yeah, it's the focus on effectiveness is the big thing. And I mean, even, you know, tithing like 10% is, I think, maybe more than most people would give. So there's an encouragement to give a bit more than average, I think. But especially to do that effectively. And just the reason for this is, if you could have one person donating 50% of their income to a random local charity, and another person giving just 5% of their income to the most effective global charities, the second person might be doing 10 times more good. And so it's actually really important to focus on the effectiveness.
Okay. But again, it's effectiveness based on the measures chosen by the effective altruism movement. Because I'll keep coming back to you. Someone might think it's very effective to fund the arts in their community. But Molly White, about this sort of, as Professor Chappell puts it, controversial lifestyle portion of it, just do we know what the lifestyle was that Sam Bankman-Fried ended up living before he got arrested?
Well, I think there's the lifestyle that he portrayed and the lifestyle that he lived. So he was broadly covered in the media as being very frugal. You know, there were a lot of stories about how he drove a beat up Toyota Corolla. He was sleeping on a beanbag in the office while he was working many, many hours a day. He had many roommates. You know, he basically was being portrayed as this very frugal guy who was sacrificing, you know, what could have been a very comfortable standard of living for charitable causes. But in reality, you know, he and his 9 roommates were actually living in a multi-million dollar penthouse in a gated community in the Bahamas. So, you know, you can sort of twist his lifestyle to portray a very frugal you know, state of being. But I think in reality, he was maybe not living quite the monastic life that was actually portrayed.
Sorry, I keep laughing because, yeah, sure, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who would love to be cohabitating with 9 other people in a giant mansion and call that frugality. Okay, but to Professor Chappell's point, this broad sort of diverse swath of people who have adopted effective altruism in their lives, many of them actually do go to great lengths to practice the frugality in their own lives that allows them to give away as much of their money as possible. So we talked to someone who's doing exactly that, Jeff Kaufman. He and his wife, Julia, live in Somerville, Massachusetts with their 3 children. And they're a pretty typical American family, except for the fact that they donate half of their income every year.
For me, it's sort of mostly sort of an obligation. I feel as a relatively well-off first worlder, it's just like not fair for me to keep all of this sort of luck to myself, and that like I should be trying to use what I have and sort of what I can do to help others. To me, it just feels like something I have to do.
Now, Jeff studied computer science in college, and when he graduated, he started making a lot of money.
I was earning more money than I ever had. I was earning more money than my parents. It was like, wow, I just graduated from college and I am able to earn a lot of money. And so to give 50% sort of felt like the least that I could be doing.
But for Jeff, having this idea of giving away that much money was really inspired by the person who was then his girlfriend and is now his wife, Julia.
I at first did not know that like she had such a strong drive to altruism, and that at some point after we'd known each other for a few months, we were walking and she was like, okay, I have something like kind of weird to tell you. It's like a pretty big thing in how I look at the world, and I want to talk through it with you and make sure you're okay with it. And she sort of like laid out how she like didn't really feel that the money that she earned was like hers, and how she felt that sort of an obligation to use it to help whoever needs it most. And I was like very interested in this because I don't know, this was a person that I liked a lot who had an idea they were taking very seriously. But like my initial reaction to it was like, okay, I think we could do separate finances.
But they did have many conversations after that, and that's when he stumbled upon the concept of effective altruism. Now, I should say that Jeff grew up in the Quaker faith, so altruism, that part of it, he says, came pretty naturally to him. But the effectiveness part really caught his attention.
Quaker morality is not especially effectiveness-focused. That is, like, very alien to a sort of traditional Quaker mindset. It certainly wasn't how people were thinking in the Quaker meeting where I grew up. Whereas, like, in my sort of, like, day-to-day life doing technical work, you do often need to make, like, pretty strange comparisons. Caring about effectiveness is, like, very much something that comes up.
Well, in 2009, the couple decided to join the effective altruism movement. Jeff planned to follow the earn-to-give philosophy, which means he would try to make as much money as he could so he could donate more. Julia decided to work for a nonprofit where she didn't make as much but was directly giving through her work. Now, Jeff started at Google in 2014, and as mentioned, they've donated 50% of their income every year. Half of that, about half of it, goes to charities that the research shows help people in the way that Professor Richard Chappell was describing, and the rest goes to building the effective altruism movement.
In terms of our day-to-day life, it wasn't a big change because we were both recently graduated from college and our expenses just weren't that high yet. So this was mostly a matter of not increasing my expenses. In general, I think it's just much, much harder to decide to live on less than you have been than it is to avoid increasing your spending as you earn more. I think if you're used to some sort of standard of living, staying at that standard of living is basically fine. And like increasing the standard of living, like that feels nice. Decreasing the standard of living, oh my God, that is really painful.
Okay, things did start to change when the couple decided to have children and life got more expensive, but they kept doing things to hold costs down. Living with roommates, they share a house with four other adults. They were carless for many years until they started sharing a car with a housemate. And if they do go on vacation, it's always somewhere where they can drive to and stay with friends or family. Now, by June, though, Jeff had left his very high-paying job at Google because he decided he didn't want to earn to give anymore and would rather donate slightly less money but give to the community through the work he was doing. So at his new job, Jeff is working on building systems to collect wastewater samples in order to catch future pandemics, which, of course, pandemic preparedness happens to be still an effective altruism goal. He's making three quarters less than he did before, but he thinks his new job is actually giving more to the community directly. Nevertheless, he has no regrets of all those years he was earning to give.
Over the past like 13 years, my wife and I have donated about $2 million to charity, about half of that to like GiveWell's recommendations. GiveWell's sort of like estimate of cost per life saved has varied over this time. But if you put it sort of like conservatively at around like $5,000 per life saved, then a million divided by 5,000 is something like 200. I don't know. I feel very proud of that.
All right. So that's Jeff. He lives in Somerville, Massachusetts, a practitioner of effective altruism in his life and his family's life. Now, Professor Richard Chappell, what I would like to understand, though, is how the effective altruism movement has matured and the impact that Sam Bankman-Fried may have on it. And specifically because there was an article in New Yorker magazine that talked about Will McCaskill, who we had discussed earlier, who actually, I think he himself lives quite a frugal life. And in this article, the writer says that McCaskill understood better than anyone that the endurance of the movement rests on a fragile foundation of social norms, not what they argued, but how they lived. And then the New Yorker goes on to say, in the course of time spent with McCaskill this past spring, he returned again and again to his concern that something crucial had been lost as the initial code of frugality gives way to material abundance and, I would say, the proximity to extreme wealth and power. What's your response to that, Professor Chappell?
Yeah, no, it raises really complex issues. I mean, so there early on, there weren't many funders for effective altruism. It was basically, you know, a bunch of grad students donating what they could and trying to do some good through that. And then over time, it has grown significantly, and you know, potentially I mean, with the loss of FTX funding, there's not the billions of funding for effective altruism that we had thought that there was. But hopefully over time, more more wealthy people might learn about the ideas and decide that it's more worthwhile to help others than to just buy yachts for themselves. And if that happens again, then hopefully there'll be more resources that continue to be available for doing more good into the future. And it does raise difficult questions about how the movement should respond to having that kind of material abundance, that those kind of resources backing it. It changes a lot the kinds of work you can do, the kinds of conferences you can put on, the ways of trying to get the attention of policymakers. It makes for a very different kind of environment.
Do you see a change going on in what effective altruism is all about? Because I think Sam Bankman-Fried's partner, or someone who once dated him and was also the CEO of Alameda Research, Caroline Ellison, at one point in time made the argument on an effective altruism forum that frugality was a vestigial concern, in her words. But I do wonder how much that actually matters, because you could see that as the more that the movement grows and perhaps the more extremely wealthy people it attracts. Is it the same creed as it once was?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's the same underlying impulse of wanting to help others as effectively as possible. And that's been constant throughout. There has been a bit of a shift in focus in recent years, where early on, the focus was pretty much exclusively on global poverty. And then over time, different cause areas got added to that. They talked about factory farmed animals, about protecting future generations. And especially the latter, since it's so much more speculative about how to help protect the future of humanity with things like pandemic prevention, AI risk, worries about future technology and how to make sure that that's deployed safely and in a way that is compatible with our interests as humans. There's a lot of uncertainty there. And so that does raise different issues compared to just, donating to anti-malarial bed nets. There continues to be a lot of interest in global health too. I mean, I think effective altruists donated more in total in the past year to global health charities than they had in any previous year. So it's still a huge area, but there are more supplemental other areas that are being explored. And that calls for slightly different standards in terms of the robustness of evidence and how certain we are and that it's doing good. There's just a lot more uncertainty.
You know, one thing keeps popping up on our social media, and it's a question that's also jumped into my head multiple times. For example, a listener says, we should not have to rely on the generosity of billionaires for our needs. We have a democratic system to meet those needs. It's called government. Effective altruism is another form of trickle-down politics. We know how that works for us non-billionaires, so instead, let them pay taxes. We only have a few seconds before the show wraps up, and Molly, you've been just listening so patiently here. I'm going to give you the last word. I mean, what's the lesson you think we ought to take away from Sam Bankman-Fried and what he practiced as his version of effective altruism?
Well, I think that, it is reasonable to want to be as effective as possible when it comes to charitable giving, but, you can also twist that in a pretty extreme way. And I think that, ultimately, Sam Bankman-Fried has shown that, if we were to play this out in an alternate universe, it may have been more effective long term for him to make less money but not commit fraud and continue to give a portion of his income.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have for today. Molly White and Richard Chappell, thank you so much for joining us. This is On Point.